We're going to be talking about coral reefs and ocean acidification. We've got a great panel lined up for you. If you attended yesterday's opening plenary and you heard from Jane Lepchenko, the head of NOAA, that ocean acidification is, she considers it to be the most underreported scientific story in the world today. So we're hoping to change that this morning with a panel that focuses on ocean acidification and on coral reefs. Just to emphasize, you know, I think everyone in the room here is probably already familiar with the importance of coral reefs, the many services they provide us and the role they play in ocean ecosystems. I'm not going to go over that. We have a great panel who can answer any of your questions about that. Of course, coral reefs are also incredibly fragile, and some would argue that coral is the animal that has been most significantly impacted, or at least one of the first animals to be impacted by global climate change. And one of the reasons for this increasingly is, actually I wanted to show you a story that highlighted some of the dangers. Here's a story by J.E.N. Veron. He's from Australia. Lawrence, do you know him? He's actually arguing that the world's coral reefs may not be long for this world if current trends continue. And he attributes that threat especially to global warming, the warming of the oceans, as well as this ocean acidification. But that's not to say there's complete agreement on the matter. There are some science journalists who have questioned whether the threat from ocean acidification is exaggerated. Matt Ridley, a science journalist, has written a book called The Rational Optimist, where he critiques some of the warnings that have been laid out, and he claims that, as he says, that the problem of ocean acidification may not be as rapid, urgent, or severe as is being indicated by some quarters. So this is a really interesting topic. It's something that a lot of people don't know about. And we're really delighted to have a great group of panelists this morning who are going to try and help all of us figure it out. And do quick introductions. I'm not going to give their full bios because you have all of them, but Andrew Baker is from the University of Miami. He's going to be leading us off. And to his left, yes, to his left is Mark Aiken from NOAA. And then to Mark's left is Lawrence McCook from, he's the acting director and chief scientist of the Great Barrier Reef Marine Authority, visiting us all the way from Australia. A little bit jet lagged, I understand, but still with us. And then Jackie Savitz is a senior scientist and senior campaign director from Oceana. The order we're going to go in, as I think we've already discussed, is first Andrew, and then Mark, and then Jackie, and then Lawrence. Yeah? Okay, so without further ado, I'll turn it over to Andrew.
I didn't realize that. Great. Well, thanks, James. And thank you all for coming. Great opportunity to talk to you all about the effects of ocean acidification on coral reefs, which is a topic close to my heart. I'm a coral reef biologist at the University of Miami, and I specifically study the effects of climate change and ocean acidification on tropical reef-building corals, and specifically on the sort of potential adaptive or acclimatization mechanisms by which they might be able to cope with those impacts. So my job today is to sort of kick off this session by giving an introduction in 8 minutes or less as to what exactly corals are, why are they sort of important, how does pumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere make the oceans more acidic, and what are their effects on tropical reef-building corals, such as those we find right here in the Florida Keys? So we don't have too much time. So many of you will know corals are animals. They're very simple animals, rather like anemones. They're very related to anemones and jellyfish, and they're usually colonial, and they exist as polyps. You can see a cross-section through a polyp here. Sort of a simple jelly-like organism. And the reason why these coral animals are so important from an ecosystem point of view, is that they build skeletons. They build skeletons of calcium carbonate, and they do that by collecting or gathering calcium ions and carbonate ions from seawater, putting those together to make calcium carbonate, a particular form of calcium carbonate called aragonite. And those aragonite skeletons essentially form the building blocks of any coral reef. And so an important thing to think about is if you've got a big coral on a reef, say a coral the size of this lectern, the living coral tissue of that coral is really just a very thin skin, a veneer over that block of calcium carbonate. And these things grow very slowly. Something this size would probably be more than 100 years old, typically. And as we'll find out, these animals are very sensitive to the effects of climate change and other environmental disturbances. Part of the reason why they're sensitive, and another reason why corals are so successful in the world's shallow tropical seas, is that they're in fact symbioses. They're mutualisms or partnerships between the coral animal and these tiny single-celled photosynthetic algae we sort of loosely refer to as zooxanthellae. These algae photosynthesize, they use sunlight energy to make food, and they pass that food to the coral animal as a sort of a form of rent. And in doing so, this sets up the partnership whereby the corals pay rent and essentially make these corals photosynthetic and able to use sunlight energy, and in return they receive protection because they're actually inside the coral's very cells. So it's a mutualism, and it's what we might call an obligate mutualism, which is to say that if a reef-building coral loses its algae, it will bleach, turn white, and die, and we'll talk about that in a minute. So as I said, it's these skeletons which, piled one upon each other, eventually build the structure upon which a coral reef ecosystem depends. So just as you can't have a tropical rainforest without any trees, you can't have a coral reef ecosystem without any corals. And so while ecosystemically, as biologists, we're worried about the way that these ecosystems respond, what happens to the coral reef fish, what happens to all of the other millions of species that depend on these systems, it's really the corals themselves, of which there are only a few hundred different types, that are really the critical ecosystem engineers, as we like to call them, the things that actually build the habitat and the structure upon which everything else depends. So they're sort of the linchpins. So how does ocean acidification affect these organisms? Well, very briefly, this is a nice graphic that was produced a few years ago. As we pump carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, carbon dioxide has to equilibrate with seawater. So we can't have a high concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and a low concentration in the oceans. They have to equilibrate. And so carbon dioxide dissolves in seawater where it combines with water, that's that CO2 plus H2O, to form something we call bicarbonate, which is HCO3 minus, as well as a proton, that H plus, that hydrogen atom. And it's those H pluses, those hydrogen atoms, that essentially make the conditions more acidic. So you remember that acidity is actually defined by the number of these H plus ions in the water. So as we put carbon dioxide in, we're essentially generating more H plus hydrogen ions. But the interesting thing about this, because ultimately what happens, as we'll see in a minute, that as we put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, we actually make it more difficult for corals to calcify and produce calcium carbonate skeletons because we decrease the amount of carbonate ions in seawater. And some people have a problem getting their heads around that. It seems like if you put more CO2 into the ocean, you would have more CO3, which is the carbonate ion that is the ingredient of skeleton building. But actually that's not the case, and you can sort of see why here, and I'll step over here. And the reason why this happens is that the proton that we've produced by dissolving carbon dioxide into seawater actually then goes to combine with carbonate to produce more bicarbonate. And by sucking out the carbonate, it essentially means that there's less carbonate available for the production of calcium carbonate skeleton, which is formed by calcium plus carbonate. And so it's a sort of a complicated equilibrium in which the addition of CO2 creates more hydrogen atoms and makes the oceans more acidic, which in turn suck up the carbonate and deplete the pool of the reservoir of carbonate that's available for corals to build their skeletons. So what effect does... What effect does that have on corals? Well, really, I think the worst effects are likely to be seen in the future. And the reason for that is the latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Predictions, the IPCC4, predicts a decrease of somewhere between 0.2 and 0.5 pH units as a result of various projections in terms of the amount of carbon dioxide that we're going to put in the atmosphere. That may not seem like a lot, 0.2 to 0.5 pH units, but pH is a logarithmic scale, which is to say that every unit is 10 times greater than the unit before. So a doubling of pH, or a doubling of acidity, if you like, corresponds to about a pH decrease of about 0.3. So we're expecting to see, you know, approximately at least a doubling of acidity by the end of the current century. And what that means is that aragonite saturation state will probably decrease by about 50%. What do I mean by aragonite saturation state? Well, it's essentially the abundance of that carbonate ion in the equation. This thing right here that is going to go down as a result of the increase in acidity that we're projecting by, as a consequence of the CO2 entering the oceans. What happens to corals? Well, as that reservoir of carbonate decreases and is depleted, experiments have shown, these are experiments undertaken in mesocosms, controlled laboratory environments where we can actually raise corals under different projected scenarios of climate change. And some of these are done here at the University of Miami, a colleague of mine, Chris Langdon. What we can see is that if we take the pre-industrial state of aragonite, the amount of carbonate ion that we know was present in the ocean at that point, and call that sort of standardize things to that rate, call it 100%, we can then see that as we move through the future, here we are, 2006, when the study was done, we're down to about 80% of the pre-industrial rate. By 2065, we're down to about 60-odd percent, and by 2100, we're to a little above 50%. So what that means is that corals are going to be calcifying and building skeletons much more slowly, we think, than they have been doing in the recent past. Now, there's a double problem here that carbon dioxide, as you all know, not only makes the oceans more acidic, but it also acts as a greenhouse gas and therefore causes the oceans to warm up. And we've known for some time now that corals, and in particular this coral symbiosis between the animal and these algae, is very fragile to temperature increases. And IPCC predicts global warming increases of 2 to 4 degrees centigrade. What's that going to cause? It's going to cause a breakdown of this symbiosis between corals and algae, leading to what we call coral bleaching. Bleached corals are not dead corals. They can recover, but they have a sort of a narrow window in which to do so. And so what really worries us as biologists is that carbon dioxide is the ultimate threat for corals, because it will hit reef-building corals in two different ways, both by the effects of warming and by the effects of decreased calcification as a result of ocean acidification. So it's sort of a double whammy, if you like. And there's few, if any, ecosystems that are so severely affected by carbon dioxide as coral reefs because of this very particular property they have, in which that they are affected by increasing temperatures and by increasing CO2, increasing acidity. And this combination of conditions that we expect by 2100 of high acidity and high temperatures is a set of conditions that we haven't experienced on this planet for at least 50 million years since the Eocene. And so scientists like to refer to this as sort of a no-analog Earth. We've got no comparison for these set of conditions. And so I think it's hard for any of us to pretend that we know what's going to happen, because there is nothing that we can compare this to. These conditions have not occurred for 50 million years. And I think it's interesting and somewhat alarming that if we look back through the geological history of life on this planet, we've seen five major mass extinctions. The one thing that they all have in common are changes in the Earth's planetary temperatures and the acidification of the ocean. So they all have high CO2 and high temperatures implicated in them. So here we are in the middle of an uncontrolled experiment. We're essentially trying to duplicate the very conditions that caused mass extinctions in the past. So we perhaps ought not to be surprised that we could see some alarming consequences. So I think I will finish there and hand over to my colleague from NOAA, Mark Akin, and we'll save all your questions until the end when we've all spoken.
So we'll tag team here, because a lot of the introduction that Andrew just gave really gives you an idea of some of the things going on with bleaching and with acidification. I'll be touching on both of those again, and then also talking about some of the interactions between the two that are very important, because it's not just either one alone that has an impact. It's both together. So you saw some of this from Andrew a moment ago, that as CO2 is increasing in the atmosphere, it's also increasing in the ocean. It works just like a soda bottle. There's nothing special about this, no special chemistry. If you leave out a can of soda on the table, it's going to go flat because the CO2 in it is going to equalize with what's in the air. Same thing's happening here. You increase what's in the atmosphere, it goes into the ocean. Simple as that. As that CO2 increases, we're seeing this drop in pH as things become more acidic. Not actually acid, but more acidic than they were previously. And along with that, we're seeing this drop in the carbonate ion that Andrew talked about. Now, the interesting thing is we're now at this point where with the rapid changes we're seeing in this century, we're going to see a major shift from what has gone on so far. So far to this point, the changes have been relatively gradual compared to what they'll be doing later on this century. Some work that's been done, a combination of ocean surveys and models to look at what the ocean looked like. This is that aragonite saturation state that Andrew was talking about. The blues up here are optimal conditions for coral growth. Red down here are really, really bad. And what you're looking at is in 1875, your pre-industrial conditions, you had conditions that were really good, optimal for coral growth throughout the tropical regions where you find reefs. By now, we've seen that fading substantially, but the big change you see as you move into the mid part of this century is that by then we're going to be in conditions that are marginal for coral growth, and by the time we get to the end of this century, we're going to be seeing conditions that are as poor for coral growth as it was in the high latitude seas before the addition of CO2. So what does this do? This is another version of the same diagram that Andrew was showing about calcification. And what you see is over time, this calcification rate, or the amount that the corals can grow, has gone down from the pre-industrial, or the actually even higher in glacial times when CO2 was even lower, to pre-industrial times to where we are now. And so as CO2 increases in the atmosphere, we're seeing a slide down this scale. And the real question is how far we're going to go as we move into the future. Somewhere around 450 to 500 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere, which is going to be happening by, about 2035, we'll be reaching conditions that a lot of people feel passes the point where coral reefs can keep up that net balance between natural forces of erosion and the forces that build them. And so before we get to double CO2, which will be about mid-century at the rate we're going, we're going to pass this point where reefs are no longer able to be net depositing coral. As we get farther down, if we get to the point of net dissolution, corals that look like this get changed to look like sea anemones like this. This was an experiment that was done with some Mediterranean corals. And these are nice and healthy and happy, except you know what you call a coral without its protective skeleton?
Food.
Hors d'oeuvres. You know, they've now lost the protection that kept them going. But it's not just the structure of building coral that's important. There's another thing. Let's take a look at a natural analog for the future. Eastern Pacific Ocean, you have very low saturation states of calcium carbonate already. In other words, the conditions are naturally more acidic because of upwelling. If we compare that to what goes on in Florida, this is what looks like inside a coral after the pore space inside it starts getting filled in by natural cementation. In other words, what takes corals and turns them into reefs? It's the glue. It's the cement. It's that mortar that binds the reef together. And you get all these crystals in there. If you look at coral spaces like that in Panama, what you see is this, and yes, you can tell the difference. These are all infilled with crystals. These are all holes. There's no cementation going on. The reefs here, you can step on them and cause reefs to collapse. They crush readily. Water flows right through them. It's a very different situation. And that could be part of what we're looking at in the future. So it's not just coral growth, but it's the cements that bind reefs together and make them into those solid structures. So it's the combination of two things on the building side. The cementation along with calcification are both very important. And that natural balance I mentioned a moment ago is opposite the bioerosion, the organisms that eat away at coral reefs, the dissolution that happens naturally. As we move into the future, we're reducing both of these, and there are signs that we're actually increasing both of these as well. And so the balance is being shifted. This doesn't mean that reefs are going to vanish. It's not like dropping Alka-Seltzer into a glass of water. You know, they don't start fizzing and go away. But what we're seeing is something more like osteoporosis. The corals and the reefs are no longer able to build and be strong like they were previously. But there's a stark difference between the two things we talked about a moment ago, bleaching and acidification. When you see a bleached coral next to an unbleached coral, it's in your face. You can see that difference. Bleaching is an obvious thing. Thermal stress comes into a beautiful reef like this, and it turns it white like this. It's obvious. This is a poster child. You can put this on a newspaper front page, and people say, wow, what's going on here? Ocean acidification? Not so much. And that's what makes it really tough. It's an insidious problem. Because unlike this, which leads to the mortality of corals, the final result with ocean acidification is the loss of reef structure. So you're really flattening the reef. So let me give you two quick examples of how these two actually interact with each other. A study by Ken Anthony found that if you take, in this case, this is a crustose coralline algae, very important in binding reefs together, a branching coral, a massive coral. In each of these cases, as you go from high pH or low CO2 conditions to high CO2 conditions, so this is becoming more acidic to the right in each one of these, what you can see is the same temperatures. This is 25 degrees in gray, this is 28 degrees in black. At each of those conditions, as you go to higher acidity, you're seeing more bleaching of the corals. So as you make the water more acidic, they are more susceptible to bleaching at the same temperatures. The flip side of that, there are actually corals that have been shown that they can use bicarbonate. Andrew was talking about the bicarbonate and the carbonate. Bicarbonate actually increases with acidification, and there's some corals who can use it. Great. And there are always going to be winners and losers in anything that goes on. But this is what happens with one of those winners. This coral, not only as you go from a normal pH of 8.1 up to a low pH of 7.4, it actually increases its rate of calcification. This is good, right? Well, the only problem is when you get into the warm part of the year, they can't do it anymore. It's too expensive a process, and they aren't able metabolically to keep that pathway going. So that means even the corals that are likely to be able to do well under acidic conditions, when you add heat to that, they're not able to keep up any longer. This is a very important problem that we're concerned about at NOAA. We monitor coral bleaching through looking at sea surface temperatures from satellites. We're now actually using satellites for the Caribbean to look at changes in acidification, both on an annual basis and a monthly basis. And the interesting thing that you see is that if you look back here just at 1988, there's your range of variability from summer to winter. And now, your range of variability is down here, so that the best conditions now are worse than the worst conditions were just back in 1988. That's how fast it's happening right here where you're sitting. So with that, there are two things we've got to do to deal with the problem. The first, and absolutely the only one that's going to take care of ocean acidification, is reducing atmospheric CO2. You'll notice I didn't say reducing emissions. Emissions is how much you're making it worse. We've actually got to get them down. 350 is a good figure. Charlie Varon, who James spoke about earlier, says 320. I won't argue with that. The point is they're both a lot lower than where we are today. We've got to get down from current 394, more or less, down to something like 350 or so. In the meantime, though, reef managers, people can work locally to build resilience by doing things like reducing bleaching, increasing the survival of corals, aiding the recovery, and planning networks of marine protected areas to protect those corals so they have more of a chance to survive between now and the time that we get CO2 back under control. Thanks. And now over to Jackie.
Thanks, Mark. That was great. And thanks, James, for inviting me to be on this panel today. Can everybody hear me? Good morning. My name is Jackie Savitz. I'm Senior Campaign Director for Oceana. I lead Oceana's pollution campaigns, including our climate and energy campaign. And a big focus of our climate and energy work is this issue of ocean acidification, because it's one of the places where climate change meets the oceans, and something that we're very concerned about. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to pick up from where Mark left off and talk about some of the untold stories, some of the other animals that are affected by climate change, by ocean acidification, in addition to corals. Even though corals are very interesting and sexy, there's some other creatures that we ought to also be thinking about. And we have some reports called The Untold Stories that we've actually got, I think, in the back of the room, or you could see our communications director, Diane Sines, who's here, right there, if you'd like, and we have them on jump drives as well. Then I'm going to shift a little bit and think about, well, what do we have to do if we want to get a handle on this, if we want to do, as Mark says, and not just cut carbon emissions, but actually get ourselves back to a number that allows coral reefs to continue to prosper. So those are sort of the two parts of what I'm going to talk about. How do I advance? Just through the... Okay. So one of the animals I'll start with is pteropods, and I know some of you have heard about pteropods. They have been written about a little bit. They're kind of like a cross between an underwater snail and a sea butterfly. They're very important animals. They're part of the zooplankton, and they're part of the base of the food chain, and a lot of animals eat them, even though most of us have never seen one. They're very important to things like the North Pacific salmon. Some North Pacific salmon species get about half of their diet. These are juvenile pink salmon, for example, made up of pteropods. And pteropods are expected to have a really hard time when the oceans begin to acidify. We expect the pteropod shells to begin to dissolve. And you can see this transition from David Litschwager from National Geographic of an actual study that was done, I believe, by Dr. Fabry in California, where the pteropod shell is actually dissolving in about 45 days. Now, this is not a good thing if you're a juvenile pink salmon and you want about half your diet to be pteropods. And so there's really two kinds of impacts I want to talk about. One are what I call indirect impacts, or they call them knock-on effects, when some animal gets affected and you're a juvenile pink salmon and then that affects you on up the food chain. But I also want to talk about some direct effects of acidification on other species. So this is the base of the food chain, so let's talk about some of the knock-on effects. You're a juvenile pink salmon, that's bad. But these are also important food for other fish. Cod, mackerel, herring, all eat pteropods, and all risk impacts to their populations if bad things happen to pteropods. Resident killer whales in the Pacific Northwest also eat juvenile pink salmon. So, actually... They eat some salmon. I'm not sure if they're juvenile Pacific salmon. But anyhow, some resident killer whales get about 90% of their diet from salmon. So you can see this food web disruption from the pteropod to the salmon to the killer whale. Obviously not a good thing, not what we're shooting for. Similarly, we expect threats to important shellfish. This can be shellfish like mollusks, clams, oysters, mussels. I like to say some of my favorites. And part of the problem with these animals is that they're trying to also build shells using calcium carbonate. In addition to those, we've also seen effects on things like sea urchins and lobster. Arthropods can also be affected by ocean acidification, not because they're building calcium carbonate shells, but they're building chitin shells, and they require calcium carbonate to strengthen those shells. So again, some of my favorites, shrimp, crabs, lobsters, also likely to be affected by ocean acidification. And the lobster fishery is worth more than $300 million. So, you know, this has a major impact, not just on the animals, but also, obviously, on the commercial fishery, on the people who depend on that for their incomes, and, of course, also on people who depend on these species for food. So this effect up the food chain comes all the way up to us humans. And what we can see in some places, especially in, for example, developing island nations, is that this can actually lead to food security issues. Some of the places, Dr. Cooley put out a paper just a couple of months ago looking at places like Haiti and Senegal, Madagascar, places where they're heavily dependent on marine animals like mollusks and arthropods for food, and they don't have a lot of ability to shift to other options. And some of those countries are going to see some serious problems. You also see behavioral and physiological effects on some animals. This is a picture of a squid. I often think, you know, if you're a squid, you know everybody's after you because people are using you for fishing bait. So if you're a squid, you got to be able to get away. And squids are actually sort of famous among scientists for being very fast, amazing ability to propel themselves through the water. And part of the way they do that is by having being able to take up and use a lot of oxygen. And one of the expectations with acidification is that it's actually going to affect the ability of the squid to take up that oxygen, which can affect its ability to propel itself and escape predators and catch its own food. So acidification, not a good thing if you're a squid. There are also concerns about acidification effects on fish. And this is in the very stages, I think, of scientific study, not as far along as some of the work that's been done on corals. But, for example, a couple things that can happen with fish, they need to be able to detect cues through their environment that they detect through their sense of smell, basically. And so that can allow them to know whether there's predators around, whether there's food around, that there's some kind of a danger. And so one of the studies has shown very well that clownfish, also now referred to as the Nemo fish, have more difficulty finding their safe haven, which of course is their anemone home, when they are in a lower acidic, a more acidic environment. So that's a concern. They can also show that these fish are less able to avoid their predators in those circumstances. And that results in higher predation rates. And, you know, if you're a fish, you know, I like to say it's a dog-eat-dog world in the ocean because these guys are all trying to survive. They've got predators coming after them. They're desperately looking for food. And you make one change, and that makes it much harder. There's also some concern about fish's ability to get oxygen out of the water when you're in more acidic conditions. Now, this is being driven by CO2 and nothing else. It can have major effects on commercial. We're starting to see effects on commercial applications in the ocean with the Pacific oyster fishermen who have seen declines in their ability to harvest oysters. And this is a very important undertaking in the Pacific. And this is happening now. There are impacts happening now. These guys, when they were able to find ways to solve the acidification problem in their local area, the oysters started to come back. I was going to talk about the Great Barrier Reef, but I'll leave that to Lawrence. But yes, that is me in the Great Barrier Reef. Okay, so what are we going to do about it? You know, trying to get back to 350 is not going to be easy. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says that that we need to start making some serious reductions. This is the current trajectory of carbon dioxide emissions over time. This is a projection of emissions continuing to grow at a high rate. This is what happens if they continue to grow at what they projected as a lower rate. But this is what we need. Okay. The Intergovernmental Panel says the industrialized countries should reduce their carbon dioxide emissions by about 45%. By 2020, over 1990 levels. That is a major change. And furthermore, that we should reduce our emissions by 80 to 95% by 2050. That's a complete change in the way we do business with fossil fuels. That means we actually have to stop using fossil fuels pretty much entirely by 2050. And this is not Oceana. These are intergovernmental panel numbers. And so that means we need to make a shift away from fossil fuels starting now. There's no other way to look at it unless you just decide we don't need coral reefs, we don't need marine life, we don't need shellfish, you know, but I don't think anybody feels that way. So how do we do this? We can do this. There are promising trends. Offshore wind offers a lot of potential. Oceana's looking at very closely at how do we do offshore wind right. That can provide enough energy to power basically the whole country ultimately in the long term. Solar, cutting shipping emissions, and biofuels also hold a lot of promise. And the last thing I'll say is clean energy can provide a lot of jobs. You know right now, I know you're all reporting on the environment, jobs is a hot topic, but it's not jobs versus the environment, it's jobs versus jobs. We want dirty jobs, the energy of the past, or clean jobs, the energy of the future. It won't happen overnight, but if we stop subsidizing fossil fuels and start supporting clean energy companies, we can really remove barriers to good ideas and basically save the oceans. Thank you.
Well, thanks, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Lawrence McCook. I'm from the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority. You can tell by my accent that's in Australia. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to try and broaden things out a little in perspective here. Coral reefs are places of extraordinary and spectacular beauty. They're also incredibly important ecologically and socially and economically. On the Great Barrier Reef, it's been estimated that the Great Barrier Reef brings in about $5.5 billion to the Australian economy each year, most of it from tourism. But tragically, those values of coral reefs around the world are under very serious threat. from the various kinds of things that we've been hearing about this morning, degrading the value of them. And that tragedy is compounded by the fact that most of the world's coral reefs are in relatively poor parts of the world, relatively undeveloped nations. This is a site of a bomb fishing site in Sulawesi in Indonesia. And so that means that countries like the US and Australia, which have the privilege of being relatively wealthy and having large areas of coral reef, are very privileged. In the Great Barrier Reef, we have the world's largest coral reef system, so fabulous that it's been made into a World Heritage Area. But with that privilege comes a real responsibility, and that responsibility is to look after the values of the reef and to protect them. Because if we can't do it in the relatively wealthy countries, who can? So what can we do about that? Without a doubt, the greatest threat in the long term to coral reefs is the threats of climate change, as you've been hearing this morning, ocean acidification and rising sea temperatures. And that means that it is essential, as you've been hearing, that we start to reduce global greenhouse gas emissions. Now, in Australia, our parliament is in the process of passing a carbon tax, which should provide a price mechanism to try to achieve that goal. I'm no economist, but we are now at the point, ladies and gentlemen, where it matters less exactly how we achieve this and more that we do achieve it and achieve it very soon. So that's all well and good, but as people have told you this morning, we're already committed to significant climate change, and that is going to have very serious impacts on coral reefs as they stand. So what can we do about that? Mark mentioned the need to have significant areas of marine protected areas. On the Great Barrier Reef in 2004... With vast amounts of sediments and nutrients and other pollutants coming from the land, coming from agriculture, coming from urban development and so on. This is the bottom picture is on an island off Sulawesi, and you can see the enormous amount of rubbish that's been thrown into the water. That has very serious consequences for reefs and reduces their ability to recover from other stresses like climate change. So we're lucky in Australia. We now have a reef water quality protection plan, which includes clear incentives and regulations for farmers and other sources of terrestrial pollution to provide the mechanisms to reduce that kind of pollution flowing onto the reef. However, some of the causes of pollution are more serious. This is an oil spill that occurred in our very own much smaller and less spectacular version of an oil rig disaster. It was a couple of years ago, the Montara oil spill off the northwest shelf of Australia. Now, we're lucky on the Great Barrier Reef that mining and oil drilling have been banned since the inception of the marine park in 1975, but not so in very many places in the world, including our northwest shelf. Now, the Australian media reported this spill as having relatively little effect because it didn't wash up on beaches on mainland Australia. The tragedy is that that belies the fact that vast areas of deep water coral reefs were seriously polluted by this event, and even in Timor, to the northwest of this area, in Indonesian Timor, this is a seaweed farm. These seaweed farmers are growing seaweed as an alternative livelihood because people like me have asked them to stop fishing so much to protect their reefs, and their seaweed farm was being polluted from oil from an Australian oil rig. It was very embarrassing when I was taken to task for that. So what do we need to do? How do we go about this thing? Well, one of the most important things we need to do is create partnerships for stewardship for coral reefs. And there are some real success stories out there. This is a gentleman by the name of Angel Alcala from the Philippines, a marine scientist, a politician, and a community member. And these are three fishermen from an island called Apo Island, where Angel Alcala, 25 or 30 years ago, created the world's first notate marine reserve in the Philippines. Not in Australia, not in the United States, but in the Philippines. And over the ensuing quarter century, not only was there massive benefits with reef recovery from all kinds of bomb damage and destructive fishing practices, the reefs are now in fantastic shape, but there are more fish there. Oops. There are more fish there. That has improved fishing for these guys that live and work on the island. And it has also created a very powerful ecotourism dive industry. So the island has benefited and the people have benefited economically and socially enormously from that. In Australia, on the Great Barrier Reef, we have now created a program called the Reef Guardian Program, which works with people like fishermen and farmers to not only try and create stewardship and partnership to look after the reef, but specifically aims to recognise and acknowledge and even reward the behaviours which improve their practices, which enhance the sustainability for the reef of fishing and farming activities. So, the challenges facing coral reefs are great, but there are success stories out there, and we can manage them and we can address them. And I just want to finish with this thought. This is a quote from my daughter in the bottom corner there when she was about 4 years old. She said to me at bedtime one night, "Me like your work, Daddy, because it makes the sea grow better and not get killed as much. I wish I could do that work when I grow up." Well, I really hope that she can, because I really hope that coral reefs are there for her to look after. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Thanks very much to the panelists, and especially for keeping on time. This is a huge, complicated, important topic, and we obviously could have gone on all day, but we want to make sure we had time for questions. We have about a half hour. You know the rules. Journalists, please, first, and in terms of asking questions. And when you do ask a question, please state your name and the organization you represent. And while I just want to mention before we start to open up to questions, I was happy Lawrence mentioned the role of developing countries. I didn't properly introduce myself. I'm the director of a project called the Earth Journalism Network. We work with journalists in developing countries to help them cover environmental issues, including oceans and coral issues. We've helped launch networks of environmental journalists in the Philippines and Indonesia. We have Imelda Abano here, who's the president of the Philippine Network of Environmental Journalists. Stand up. So if you're ever interested in learning about what's going on in the Philippines, you can talk to her and her members, or in other countries, you can talk to me. We can put you in touch with journalists in many countries around the world. Okay. Mark, you want to start off?
So I live in New Orleans.
Can you just tell us your name?
And I'm sorry, Mark Schlesstein. I'm speaking in New Orleans. In the Gulf of Mexico, there are deep water coral reefs. How is ocean acidification affecting those deeper corals?
Sorry. I can start off. The interesting thing about ocean acidification and the way that we think it's going to evolve over the next few decades is actually that it's starting off in deeper water and starting off at more polar locations, and over time the severity of the threat is both shoaling, that's to say getting shallower, and also moving towards the tropics. So you might have picked up some of that from Mark's slides showing the sort of evolution of this. But we, deep water corals that normally occur at depths of, you know, 1,000 feet or more, some of those deep water corals are found off the coasts of the Aleutian Islands at fairly shallow depths. And what's been interesting to see is that, in fact, they've been affected by this acidification threat much earlier as a result of their shallow depth and high latitude location than we would expect elsewhere. But the short answer to your question is they will all be affected by this threat, and in fact they'll be affected more quickly, sooner than the shallow water tropical reefs. So I'm sure that others have more to add.
Just a quick follow-on to that. One statistic that came from a very nice biogeographic study of deep water corals, what they found is there's a point as you go down deeper in the ocean where all of the calcium carbonate dissolves. This is called the carbonate compensation depth. And that depth is coming up with acidification. So that's moving up closer to the surface. In this biogeographic study of deep water corals, what they found was that in pre-industrial conditions, and based on what we can best estimate and by what we can see today, over 90% of the deep water corals are living above that carbonate compensation depth. By the end of this century, 75% of all deep water corals will be below that compensation depth. And so that means they will be living in a place where calcium carbonate dissolves. So it's a major change that's affecting them as well. And as Andrew said, it's one of these things that we're seeing it first and most obviously at high latitudes and deeper water for that reason.
And if I could, a real quick follow. Also, along the Louisiana coastline, we have a huge industry in oysters. How is that going to be affecting the oysters?
Well, I can tell you how it's affecting the oyster industry already in the Pacific Northwest. There, you have colder waters, you have upwelling conditions, and every year, the conditions in the ocean are actually dropping now below saturation state. So those values, you know, where I got down to where the line gets down to where corals actually dissolve at that one-to-one point, they're reaching that already. The effect that it has had was that for 3 years in a row, because of more acidic waters in some of the oyster farms up in Oregon and Washington, they were seeing a complete collapse of the natural spat, the natural influx and recruitment of new oysters in their fisheries. And so they've had to change the way that they do business to deal with the fact that that's happening, change where their water comes from in these systems and their aquaculture facilities, when they turn off their pumps so that they can, doing other things to keep the water healthier. That's already being seen, and it's having an economic effect in the Pacific Northwest already. It's just going to be a matter of time before you start seeing those same sort of effects in places like New Orleans.
Can I just add one thing to that? Because I think that's an important, it brings up a very important point. Besides the important point that there are impacts happening now, we can point to stories where acidification is visible and where it's affecting commercial operations. But the point I really want to make is one of the criticisms that we've had of ourselves as a community trying to talk about this issue is it's really hard to point to real-world examples of how this is happening. And the reason for that is because science takes time. And, you know, you have to have a certain period of time before you can actually show an impact. And oftentimes, that period of time takes you to a point where it's already happened or it's impossible to fix. And so I think it's an important question for a journalist audience to think about is, I know you need real-world examples, but the limited amount of real-world examples does not mean it's not happening. It simply means we just don't have them yet.
One last quick point about deep-sea corals, since you brought it up, is deep-sea corals grow much more slowly than tropical shallow-water corals. And so if we're thinking about threats to calcification and growth rates, it's worth keeping in mind that those deep-sea corals that already grow perhaps 10 times or more slowly than the shallow tropical corals that are powered by sunlight, you can see that the effects are going to be even worse, that these corals that are already very, very slow-growing, a coral this size can be a century old, is going to grow even more slowly as a result of acidification in deep water.
Ken?
Ken Longstreet, the LA Times. So acidification has been fairly undercovered and kind of a quiet thing, but I guess you folks have arrived now that the rational optimist, as James has presented a contrarian view. I don't know if any of you have seen this. I wasn't aware of this. This fellow rebels of his contrarianism. Is there anything that he's pointed out? You've read this.
Some of it does. The important thing that you've already heard from us is that this is something that we're not seeing as obviously. It's not as advanced a problem. It's not an issue that's having as much of an impact now as, say, coral bleaching. In the case of shallow water coral reefs, you know, you see what's happening from overfishing. You see what sediment is doing to reefs. You see what's happening with bleaching. If I tell you that corals are growing 15% slower now than they were two decades ago, is that going to really excite you? You know, and the other point is that it doesn't matter how fast a coral grows if it's dead. So some of the aspects that are brought out in that article about it not being as big a threat right now, yeah. But, you know, do you want to wait until the train's already wrecked before you deal with the problem? What we're looking at is we know that overfishing is a major issue. We know habitat destruction is a major issue. We know that sediment and nutrient pollution are major issues. We are already seeing the climate change effects causing bleaching over and over of coral reefs. And we're heading toward a place where those corals are going to be growing more slowly and the reefs aren't going to be cementing together. Do we really want to get that far? So when he says it's not as big a problem yet, sure. I do have a problem with the article and the way that it's written. It's some of the most selective and poorly chosen sets of statistics you can imagine, where he makes a point by saying that the rate of warming now is much slower than it was in some of these times that we saw in the deglaciation and during the Younger Dryas. But what does he do? He compares global rates against rates in Greenland, rates in Antarctica. So when you read through it, the way it's written is pretty hideous. Sure, it's not as big a problem yet.
I might just make one follow-up comment, and that is, As someone who works in reef management rather than reef science, you know, my job is to ask, what do we do about it? And people tend to operate in this mindset of, you need proof before you address a problem. Well, do you need proof that the train is going to wreck, or there is going to be a train wreck, before you do things to reduce the chances of it? My kids go to a school in Townsville in Australia with a busy street outside. Do I need proof that they're going to get run over crossing the street outside the school before I want to take measures to reduce the likelihood and the consequences of that accident happening? And the answer is obviously no, I don't need proof. I want to prevent that. But here's another really important point, because we tend to hear about the environment and the economy. Well, dealing with a train wreck is really, really expensive. It's a lot more expensive than preventing the train wreck. And the same is true of most of the consequences of the kinds of things we're concerned about happening due to climate change. You know, reducing fossil fuel dependency has so many benefits other than protecting coral reefs. It's a bit of a no-brainer.
Of course, dealing with train wrecks is good for GDP growth, so that's one of the perverse incentives we have in our economic system.
There's economics, and then there's economics.
Okay, Perry, and then, yeah.
Good morning, I'm Perry Beeman of the Des Moines Register. You're talking about carbon dioxide and the role it has in this mechanism, and obviously the nutrient runoff is not good for reefs, but I'm curious, does nutrient runoff itself feed into this acidification mechanism?
Well, not directly, but obviously this kind of harks back to the question that was just raised, which is that, you know, if we're trying to detect the effects of ocean acidification on reefs, it's very difficult in the current century, you know, given out the records that we have, to disentangle and point to the effects of ocean acidification when there are so many other secondary combining stresses on top of that, such as, you know, poor water quality caused by nutrient pollution. And so the problem that we face is, if we go and look at a long-term data set and actually try and figure out how much of the reduction in coral growth that has occurred over the last 50 years, you know, is due to the effects of declining pH versus the fact that, you know, water quality is not as good, light levels are not as high, therefore they're not getting as much food and they're not growing. So there is an interaction between detecting the effects of acidification and things like nutrification. But nutrification in and of itself is not a direct factor that will contribute to the acidification stress.
There is one thing, though. I was talking about the interacting effects of temperature and acidification, that more acidic conditions make it easier for corals to bleach. Well, the same thing has been found with nutrients. As you increase nutrients at the same temperature, corals are more likely to bleach. So while it's not affecting ocean acidification, what that means is, as you increase CO2 in the atmosphere and the water, as you increase nutrients in the water, both of those are combining to make it more likely that corals are going to bleach and, in many cases, die.
And then the final point to make there is that we may not know. So it may well be that nobody has done the correct experiment to identify those kinds of things. I think as one of your leaders commented, there's the things you know, and the things you don't know that you don't know, and so on. So very often these kinds of effects emerge as more work gets done, as Jackie pointed out. And, you know, we don't want to wait until we've done all of the research thoroughly to understand the mechanisms.
And the experiments are actually underway right now at the University of Queensland, among other places.
Obviously, it's going to take time to...
Can you state your name, please?
Oh, my name is Sharon Bynum from the Lancet. Obviously, it's going to take time to reduce carbon inputs and see the results of that. What kind of mitigations can be done now that might, you know, help protect coral reefs, at least in the short term?
Yeah, there's a book that we produced, in fact, in association with the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority a few years back, called A Reef Manager's Guide to Coral Bleaching. It deals with all of the things in looking at coral bleaching, how to deal with a bleaching event. And then it gets into these issues of resilience, how to make a reef more resilient to these sorts of things. We're actually starting the process of doing a new version that's a reef manager's guide to ocean, to climate change, and it brings in ocean acidification, brings in all of these things. The important part is, because it's going to take so long to turn around this problem, we've got to do everything that we should have been doing already, reducing nutrients, reducing sediments, making sure that the reefs aren't overfished, especially the herbivores, the plant-eating fish that are so important to keeping the algal growth down. We need to work in areas to reduce those local stresses and really protect those areas that have natural forms of protection to be able to make sure that these reefs are going to survive long enough for us to get the CO2 problem under control.
So this acidification and bleaching is changing the food web. And like if pteropods disappear and salmon can't eat them, nature hates a vacuum. So some other creature will fill that vacuum. Maybe it won't be so edible, but there will be life. So my question is, are people looking sort of on beyond the most horrible nightmare and trying to figure out how the food chain, how the food wealth will adjust? And secondly, is it possible that even should we get this under control, that we manage to sort of reduce acidification, could there be changes enough in the food chain that even if the conditions are good, that the web is sufficiently disturbed that the reefs can't come back because other creatures have taken their place? Anyway.
I could address the first part of that, and I'm sure others can contribute too. So coral reefs are pretty unique ecosystems. As I mentioned, they're the world's equivalent of the tropical rainforest. And what that means is that, you know, somewhere between 1 million and 9 million, depending on which estimate you follow, species are found on coral reefs. That's just the named ones. There's plenty of sort of other hidden biodiversity out there. And by various estimates, somewhere between 25% and 33%, a quarter and a third of the world's marine fish species depend on coral reefs at some stage of their lifespan. So if we were to lose coral reefs, it's not just that we have, you know, less organisms, but they'll just, you know, swim in and colonize the space. We'll actually have a reduction in biodiversity, fewer different species and fewer, you know, experiments in life out there. And many biologists believe that diversity actually begets stability. In other words, the more species we have in an ecosystem, the more stable that ecosystem becomes because of these reinforcing mechanisms and interactions between species. So I could imagine, given that this was sort of an imaginary question that you posed us, that if we were to lose coral reefs, we could be at the top of a very slippery slope in which the stability of the remaining marine ecosystems actually declines as a result of that loss, because, as I mentioned, we're going to lose a lot of species and not just individual organisms.
I'll just add, since I'm the one that insisted on thinking about the food web, you know, I often say, you know, we don't really have to save the Earth. The Earth is going to be fine. It's a question of preserving life as we know it on Earth. And if we're perfectly comfortable living in a very different world than we're in today, that might be okay. But the truth of the matter is, what we're looking at in some of these cases is impacts on the ecosystem that could lead to things like food scarcity, which is not fun, obviously, for anyone. You know, Sarah Cooley's study shows which countries she thinks are most likely to suffer from that, and they may not be ours initially, but there are reverberations of those problems, and you get food scarcity that leads to famine, that leads to national security issues. And I think a good example of that, and this is not acidification-driven necessarily, is the Somali fishermen. They don't have fish, so what do? They commandeer other people's ships, really expensive ships with people on them. And sometimes those people don't survive that. That's just a small microcosm of the kinds of national security issues that will start to emerge when people get hungry, or in the case of climate change more broadly, get thirsty because of water shortages. So I think it is an interesting question, and I don't mean to sound defensive at all, just that I think, you know, let's preserve life as we know it, where everybody has, or not everybody, but as many people as possible have enough food and water, and we have this amazing, amazing ecosystem, as Lawrence described it, to enjoy.
I have a question. Are coral reefs carbon sinks? And if so, is ocean acidification an example of a feedback loop that's exacerbating climate change?
Yes and no. The problem is one of scale. And this is really an issue of scale. On really, really long time scales, the time scales that we know nothing about because we're talking about longer than the time scales that human beings have been alive as human beings, much longer than civilizations. Reefs are carbon sinks. On the time scales that we're talking about, when a coral reef builds its skeleton, it releases CO2. So let me repeat that. When a coral builds its skeleton, it releases CO2. So as we increase CO2 in the atmosphere, you're doing the exact same thing as the corals are doing. So they are not serving on our time scales as carbon sinks. So what we're looking at is a system that you'll hear, well, you know, the oceans are really well buffered for pH, and it, you know, this isn't a problem. It's not a problem at 10 to 50,000 year timescales. It is a problem when you are taking us from a level of CO2 that is among the lowest you've seen during the glacial-interglacial cycles. And within 100 years, you're raising it to a value higher than we've seen in, I used to say, we know the last 800,000 years and probably the last 25,000 years. Better data have come in. It's now about 20 million years. It's now about 50 million years that we know that the CO2 levels that we're seeing now and where we're going were the last time we saw them on Earth. So we're looking at something that is a completely different situation. The no analog that Andrew was talking about is a very real problem. But it's the difference in these time scales that gets to the issue of the question you're asking.
Great, thanks.
I'm going to just extend that a little and just draw to your attention, again, the issue of time scale. The stakeholders in the Great Barrier Reef include people like my daughter, and people like the tourism industry that brings in $5 billion to the Australian economy each year. If you tell them that the Great Barrier Reef will probably adapt, but it's going to take however many thousand or tens of thousands of years, you know, in terms of their business plan, in terms of my daughter's future, that's just not cutting it. And so a lot of the conversations we hear on this issue are about what levels of things have been seen before and so on. But it's really important to consider the rates of change. Biological systems have a fantastic capacity to adapt, but at what rate And what is the disruption, and in particular, what is the disruption to humans from what we call ecosystem goods and services? Those are the things that we use, the goods and the services, the things like the provision of coastline protection and so on. Those goods and services change are disrupted in ways that are pretty heartbreaking for us to deal with, and make the kind of financial disruptions that we see and we trouble ourselves about so much, they really are blips compared to the kinds of disruptions we may see. And it all has to do with rates of change. Rates of change are far faster than have been seen before.
Okay, we've got about 5 minutes left, so I'm going to take a bunch of questions and then let each panelist. So we've got Heather, Ken, Imelda. Okay.
Heather Dewar, freelance journalist. You all mentioned that in the Pacific Northwest, the first or one of the disruptions that you're seeing as a result of acidification is a reduction or disruption of spawning. And here in South Florida, we have some very important reef-building corals that are already having severe spawning problems. They're not reproducing at a rate that's able to keep up with their deaths from reaching the disease. So my question is spawning disruption, does that seem to be an across-the-board or significant early effect of acidification? Do you know? And if so, are other organisms besides oysters already showing signs of that?
Ken?
So one of the students that I was on the committee for, who just finished a PhD, and she's now in Australia actually, looked at exactly this question, the effects of acidification on the reproductive capacity of reef-building corals here. And she found that the results, the effects of acidification were in fact more than additive. In other words, acidification had an impact on sperm motility of corals. Corals produce eggs and sperm, same way we do, and that the motility and viability of the sperm was influenced under high pH conditions. Then she looked at fertilization success and found a result there. And then she looked at settlement success. So once these eggs and sperm have fertilized one another to produce a larva, the larva then has to go and find a place to live on the substrate, on the seafloor. And the ability to settle successfully and then start to build a coral was also impacted. So, yes, acidification has deep and dramatic effects on reef-building coral reproductive behavior, not just the spawning, but all aspects of that reproductive life history. I don't know if anyone wants to contribute with other organisms, but
And she also found that for the growth rate of the young corals, right, after they arrived. And by the way, those are the Acropora corals, that are already listed as threatened on the endangered species list.
Ken.
Surprised to see, I think it was Mark's, your presentation, to the little in the collage, a shot of the shade claw, which is the Great Barrier Reef. I know that's been an experiment to try to reduce the impact of bleaching. Is there an angle with acidification? And also, I never knew what ever happened to those shade claw experiments. Were they successful in reducing bleaching? And is there a link with acidification?
The link with acidification on that one is really the sort of thing I was talking about in terms of the interacting effects. But there have been some things that have been tested for a number of corals that can do better and ecosystems that can do better under high bicarbonate conditions. There are actually some options for dissolving limestone for using the CO2 that comes out of power plants, using that to create bicarbonate-rich water and putting that into coastal systems. That may be a way that we'll be able to help out neutralizing some of the effect in some areas. There are some things that are being tested. It's farther behind. The idea of doing something as radical as shade cloth, or I guess the follow-on to that were sprinklers at the surface that were a whole lot better since your snorkelers didn't want to look down at a shade cloth. But they're also doing experiments now where they're using local water cooling, putting cool water onto bleached corals. And within 24 hours, you can see a return of coloration to bleached corals that lasts for as long as a couple of weeks. And so there are things that can be done like that on reasonably small scales, but to protect very important organisms, or in the case of Australia, where your license is for a particular reef and you've got a reason to protect it, that it can be done. Acidification, a newer topic, a little farther behind in that, and people are looking into those ideas.
So I've just emphasized the point made there about scale. So the experiments that Ken is referring to were being considered as, you know, options for looking after very small-scale areas, say a tourism venue, to protect a particular site. They're not feasible, and they're unlikely to become feasible in the near future on the scale of the Great Barrier Reef. The Great Barrier Reef is approximately 345,000 square kilometres. Sorry, I can't do that in miles for you, but anyway, it's really, really big. We have slides that we show with the east coast of the United States and down to the Caribbean measured up against the Great Barrier Reef. It's really, really big, and so we're talking about these kinds of operations to reduce impacts and small specific sites, but not as any kind of cure for global coral reef decline.
I have one last comment I'd like to make, and it reiterates something that we've touched on, but there's a real problem that we have here in the West. Everybody here, almost everybody here in the room, is from a developed world country, and you know those Australians and Americans among us have substantial reef resources here. But there's an inevitable tendency to think of coral reef ecosystems as luxury ecosystems, things that we can do without within our own sort of economies. And you know, here in South Florida, we think of the tourists and we think of diving, but we can probably imagine a life without that, one way or another. And so they seem somehow superfluous, something that we can lose with sort of impunity. But I just want to reiterate the point that's been made, that there's what's been called this global inequity of the threat to coral reefs. We're the main polluters here in the West, and yet it's the developing world, those countries in the tropics that have some of the most dramatic and valuable reef resources, that are paying the price of this. And, you know, to sort of think of an analogy, you know, if we were having this conference in California and we were talking about an environmental threat that somehow was going to take out the high-tech computer industry and the wine industry and Hollywood and the film industry, people would be pretty alarmed. And that's exactly the kind of effects that we can expect for some of these third world countries, where not only do they depend on these reef resources for all aspects of their local economies, but you know, to make matters even worse, some of these island nations that are going to that are very low-lying are going to essentially disappear as a result of sea level rise. So it's really important when we come back to coral reefs to emphasize that, you know, no matter how much we can feel the pain here in Florida or the Great Barrier Reef, it's minuscule compared to the human cost of this elsewhere in the world.
And that's a perfect segue to our last question from Imelda Abano. Go ahead.
And it's part of the coral triangle area where it shares like eight other countries. It houses 75% of all known coral reefs. My question is that, is it too late to help coral reefs survive the impacts of climate change?
Is it too late to save coral reefs from the impacts of climate change?
If it were too late to save coral reefs from the impacts of climate change, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. We're probably going to lose species. There are coral species that I think are going to be lost in the process. Some areas we're going to lose coral reefs as we know them. I don't think we're going to lose them all. I have the best hope for places like the Coral Triangle and the tremendous work that has been done in the Philippines for marine protected areas, not at the scale that was being discussed by Lawrence for, you know, a big national project, but at the level of individual villages and communities that get together and say, we're going to protect what we have. And things like that are making a real difference. It's going to be those efforts that are really important for coral reefs. The other thing is that the Coral Triangle is in the area of, with the most diversity of coral reefs for, and corals and coral reef fish and all of those coral reef organisms for a reason. And those are the areas that we're most likely to be seeing the worst effects of bleaching later. And we're going to be seeing acidification later. And so we have more chance to keep those around for a while.
So, okay. Yeah, I mean, I think those are important points. And I guess, you know, if we saw a major disaster to a city and we knew that a lot of people were going to be hurt or damaged or something, we wouldn't give up just because we didn't care about the people that were going to survive. So I don't think we can ever give up. We can't afford to stop fighting and stop struggling. And there are really positive success stories out there, especially in the Philippines.
Okay. Thank you very much, our panelists. I just want to make a final announcement.